What happened in these cases? You know, you went up before an arbitrator.
What was it? Excuse me.
An umpire.
Seven
dumb plants.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there were seven of us. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, I was blamed. Absolutely, I was
all
blamed.
All seven of you who were in the office.
Now, Department 15 led that. See, as soon as we started filing out, then the other departments were all said, all right, you're safe. 15's leading at this time, and all you have to do is say that you were tipped off by 15, and you follow out, and the plant emptied. So the plant was empty, but we were the lead-off guys that time. Okay. So they fired seven of us. That was the press room operator and the press room chief steward, or assistant chief steward, Steve Despot. I don't remember. Yeah, all right. And there were seven of us that were fired. And this time we went to an umpire. We didn't get back on the screen that time. The plant was put back in operation while
this
was
the procedure here?
Well, an umpire is the impartial guy that's going to decide for the company and for the union. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, it was the policy of the International Union to refer these grievances during the war period. Well, they still have an umpire system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was rather new then. We went up before the umpire, and I'll swear to you that man had never been in a plant. You know, you're talking to somebody about something he doesn't even know. He didn't know what it means to walk up and down with a little time clock. And finally, they took him in. They let him walk around the plant, you know, and a few things like that. He was a lawyer. And we had a lawyer. And when I was brought in, like, my lawyer said, oh, no, which firing was it? Maybe it was the first firing. The first firing, he told me. He said, Denora, he said, they're so terrified of you, the other side is. He said, I want you to go in there with a little high-collared, a little white collar and a little navy blue dress and a little hat. He said, and get a little purse and some gloves. And can you put the flowers somewhere on your head or something? So, and he said, and keep still. Don't say anything. Let me talk. And I said, oh, that's going to be hard for me to do. So I went in all dressed up like a little Miss Prim. You can't imagine. And I said this. And they were bringing in all of my activities, all of the things that I had done to this umpire. And this umpire kept looking over at me. And I was looking at them, you know, kind of frowning. I said, I can't believe you could do these, say these things about me, you know. And the lawyer said, look. She looked like that kind of a person in the umpire. We didn't catch him. You know, didn't catch him. Dad shaking his head like that, and then he caught himself. And Robinson, now remember, this is the head of the company. He said, wait just a moment. I'll bring in the files to show you. And he ordered additional files brought in. And the union objected, look, it's being held in your office. We don't have our files, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
All right, so I got put back because the umpire couldn't believe it. I was such a she-devil as all of that.
Yeah.
On the second filing,
the first filing.
I think it must have been the first one that I went in by myself. They're all dressed up like little cookies. The second firing, the seven of us came up before the umpire.
The rest of the plant was still out, or they'd come back?
They had an agreement that they would go back to work. In our case, it would go to the umpire system.
Mm-hmm.
So the plant was working. My assistant stewards were taking over. So when it came up, it was a crime. The two stewards that were the most quiet and unobtrusive and weren't nearly as bad as most of us were the ones who were left out. The other five of us were put back to work. And what was the technicality? That these two stewards had gone up when their department didn't put their cards in first. In the time clock, you see it has a time on it, to show that they led their department side. And my department was so well organized, I was in there arguing my head off, and the ordinary little people started clocking out. There was nothing that could have pin on these little ordinary people at that. Such a technicality as that. And we were really eliminated, and we got put back, and the other two innocent ones were fired.
Now,
for
the second firing took place how long after you'd been there? Do you recall?
Nope, don't recall. Happening all along, I was there. It was such a concentrated experience in my life that I don't know. It was a great learning experience for me, and it was for them too. I think it made me appreciate more and more the women, you know. Seeing these women so trained, especially foreign-born ones, so trained to wait around on their husbands and take their nickels and dimes and sometimes get beatings on weekends when their old men go down and get drunk, get fouled up, they'd say, and beat the hell out of them. Now, some of these young men went off to the army. Some of them were still at home. But whatever the situation was, these women that came in were the raw product. Believe you me, they were the raw product.
Mm-hmm.
And the only places that they had ever been was the church. Church I heard about all the time. And to their communion services and to their family reunions. And they have family gatherings and Italians and Hungarians. And they don't have they don't have travel in their lives. They don't have contact even with other ethnic groups. And of course, among the Polish, there was a strong anti-black feeling among these women. Anti-black. And it took quite some, and it was a measure of education. And while I was educating them, they were educating me. And it was a great, great experience in my life. Really
did they become involved in the local activities at all?
Oh, yes, every meeting. And it's sometimes the general meetings. We had a smaller percentage because, remember, they had to stay home with their kids on Sundays. The general meetings, the locals were on Sundays. But if there was any, and the department meetings turned out full blast all the time.
What were the meetings like? When would you have meetings and what was the
issue? We usually tried to have a department meeting over at the local hall just to get them related to the union and to have other speakers come in and to give them the reports of the full local union activities, what was going on in the international union, what was happening on the whole labor front and things like that. And sometimes a person would come in from the International Educational Department because I wanted them especially to get, not to be related to one person or to just their one department, their whole little clique, but to get in where you'd see the black workers that had come out of the Deep South and the other workers beside their own ethnic groupings, you know. This was a new experience for them.
You see the women in the crib in the inspection department, or women in the crib?
The department was Department 15.
And how often were those?
Once a month. And then, of course, as I say, we had our little meetings every day. I would go around to their tables, or if I wasn't out talking with the other, consulting with the other stewards, these are the places where I ate lunch. And I got to know them very well, and they got to know me, and they trusted me because, as I tell you, so many of the personal experiences they related to me. I was doing very little work there at one time. And that worked that superintendent to no end. I was all over the place just looking. And very often I would tell him, look, you know damn well that these women have problems. How would you like to go home and cook and sew and wash and so on, take care of kids? And if I am talking to them to try to resolve something, it's presenting a grievance, you know. So don't say anything to me, leave me alone. The other stewards were very good, and they could do this to a certain degree, but if they had a big problem, they wanted to talk to me for some reason or other. And it was a big learning experience for me.
Senora, in the department meetings, what proportion of the women from the department would come to those, the monthly meetings?
Well, now, let me see. We had 560 or 580. And out of that, I think we had about 60 veterans. The veterans usually couldn't come. They had, some of them had been wounded, and they were ill or under treatment or something. We always had one or two of the men that would come. And usually there would be 100 to 200. They would come to our overthaw. They told us we had a bigger percentage of our department turn out. And then, of course, it may not always be the same 100 or 200.
No.
They all kind of took turns.
And it was used primarily as an educational tool?
For reports, yeah. A broader report than we would have on a plant-wide basis or a department basis.
What was, as these men came back, as the veterans came back, did that change the relationships among the women in the department?
No, mainly the veterans had to be put over in a separate, most of them were over in a separate section where they could sit all the time.
Oh.
They weren't walking around, you know, you had to push your gondolas full of stock, and you had a certain amount of getting up and running around and so on, and they weren't able to. I think some of them even had blueprints checked out to them, right, where they were. The veterans didn't enter into the picture too much. They were all very sympathetic. That they were being protected completely, and they understood most of them of the value of unionism, and they were very, very friendly to us, you know, generally speaking. But they didn't feel well enough. Most of them, they were put in inspection only because they were handicapped in some way.
Mm-hmm.
If they were returned veterans and able to work, they would have gone out on their regular jobs or on a machine, a wartime machine. But if they had something quite wrong with them, then they would take them in, and if they had the qualifications. A couple of them, I think, were tour and die men before, and they came into blueprint inspection because they were quite limited in their walking around. And none of them were seriously, you know, they wouldn't take them in for insurance reasons if they were too serious and handicapped, but they were able to work and not able to do much otherwise.
Now, tell me about your position in the work you were doing within the local itself in the area.
Well, I told you I didn't get elected to the executive board, but as time went on, their appreciation of me went up and up. And remember that every one of these men were all chauvinists. Every damn one of them, and they made an exception in my case, which made me feel like an oddball, you know. And finally, it came to the point. I was on the educational committee at the local. That's what I was interested in. This is the committee. This is the educational committee here.
Mm.
And finally, it came to the point where they decided they needed a full-time educational director, and they voted me out to be a full-time educational director. And I didn't want to do it because I was afraid then that, that the FBI and the CIA, they were very, very active, would come in with all of my politics, and it would, and the SWP agreed with me also, that it might not be a good thing at this point. This was a militant local and so on, and they carried on a very good fight in the International Union. So this man was having trouble over at Ford Local 600, Frank Marquardt. He was the educational director. And they said, the only way we're not taking your no answer. The only way we'll let you out of it is if you can get somebody who is better than you are. And I said, Frank Marquardt's having trouble. Well, if you can get Frank Marquardt, I made a trip out to the local. And I told him that I had been voted out as the educational director, that I preferred. And I was running public speaking classes at this local. And every one of these guys in here were in my public speaking class. That's one of the reasons I got fired the third time, and plus a lot of others. And these guys could not talk with a damn. Emil Macy was never a great speaker, but he was practically the only speaker that you can think of in that local. The rest of them got up and talked, but they couldn't speak. They couldn't get across. They were respected more for their muscle than they were for their ability to talk and speak to the members and explain. And all these guys were in my class. And this was the one exception here that didn't turn into an excellent speaker. This guy was so phlegmatic. You know, you have to have emotions before you can become a speaker. And I kept telling them that. If you got frightened when you get up here and you get cotton in your mouth, that's your good sign. You've got emotions. And when you can overcome that, you're going to be able to relate emotionally to other people. This guy was the most phlegmatic guy you ever saw in your life. No emotions whatsoever. He could get up and talk, but he never was a good speaker. The rest of these guys, they got up and they were excellent. Excellent. Plus others, you know, other committeemen. And they, when it came to a contract negotiations once, these guys got up and the third time they had turned it down. And by this time the membership got a little tired. You know, well, let's forget this noise. We don't want to go out on strike anymore. We'd rather, you know, they accept it. These guys are so eloquent that they turned it down the third time. And, of course, I got blamed for that because I had trained them and taught the public speaking classes. And
he then became the educational director and you remained on the committee, though?
Oh, of course. Of course I remained on the committee. Sure.
Now, there seems to have been an attack against that committee as being militant and causing trouble. First there was this, I don't know quite when this was, that in the union paper apparently was this implication that you were, it said, what she still is making up to her foreman and why. And there was this...
that was the treasurer of our local. Where'd you get that from?
One of your fighters, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Claire First Land of Department 15 and her chief steward.
Claire Cook.
Who was, I guess, the editor of the local paper.
Was he the editor? I think he was the treasurer, wasn't he?
Do you recall
And this is a slant. This is the other slate. This is, oh, my God, at election time.
Oh, I see.
Oh, at election time, what they didn't pull out on you.
Oh,
yeah.
This was at election time.
And who was it? I've forgotten that. Yeah, that was one of the, oh, the slander that we got then, all of us. Maybe it's like, go call her, making up to her foreman. See, a chief steward wouldn't have to make up to a foreman. They'd have to make up to a superintendent because they're over a foreman. I don't know, maybe they,
Was this during an election, a chief steward election? Would that have been, do you think?
We work as stewards of Department 15. Well, the whole thing is misleading. The stewards were all my stewards. How would they be? Oh God, I don't remember. I don't remember this one. You know, it's not signed by anybody. Oh, wait a minute. Was this the answer to Clark Hurst?
I think so.
Oh.
I think that he probably...
Oh, then this is probably when my stewards went around. They did that on a couple of occasions when I got a tax by the other.
And it was by the other slate, in other words.
Oh, yeah, that's the editor of the paper. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember. Vaguely. But I got several attacks by the other slate.
You were running for an office, is that it? Or was it trying to keep you as a chief steward?
No, I never ran for it. See, I didn't run for the executive board. I told you, the green slate eliminated me. I didn't have to run for chief steward, no. I mean, I was reelected every time. Must have been, I was out active in the caucus. I was handing out slates. I was the educational public speaking instructor. And I had other posts in the local, two other assignments. For instance, when we had the beatings that took place, remember? Mm-hmm. I was on that special committee, too.
No, those were a little later, though.
Those were later. What's the date of that thing?
Well, the beatings seem to have been, the original beatings were in May of 45, and then when you were beaten was October of 45. So that would be later, toward the end. What you do have, though, that we went over in a year after, the On Guard, which I guess is put out by the Education Committee. This little newspaper called On Guard, Instructions for Committee Men, Chief Stewards, and Stewards. And it seemed to be some sort of weekly bulletin that was put out.
Mm-hmm. We had so many of these things. Yes, we did. We had bulletin number 4. Published by Educational Weekend, we had bulletins that would be sometimes twice a week, depended upon if there was there anything hot in that. See, Vernon Highway Plant would have a big, big problem, so we would point it up before we had to call a wildcat strike very often. And if that bulletin was circulated throughout all the other plants, Mack Avenue and Outer Drive and the rest of it, then that put the management in Vernon Highway on notice that everybody now is getting ready, you know, or getting on the muscle. And so sometimes that would be put out more than once a week.
Oh, so the education committee saw as a function that communicating to each of the divisions what was happening.
Yeah, that was part of the education and then giving little lessons. I haven't read that, but we used to give little elementary lessons in unionism.
Hmm. Would this be general membership meetings or special?
In these bulletins.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
So that most of the...
I taught public speaking and parliamentary procedure and what else? Labor history. I had a class in labor history, too. Something happened to that. I think we got that started just before the end of the, you know, when the plants turned over.
And what...
I don't know how, not very many classes in that, but okay.
Did you get a lot of people coming to those classes then with the education?
Yeah, we got pretty good attendance. It wasn't easy during those days. Everything was so hectic. We had classes. Let me see. I'm trying to figure what size the room would be, and it would be filled. It would be a room at least twice this size. Oh, 3 or 4 times this size.
It's about 50 by 20.
Uh-huh. And the person would be standing up in front with the lectern. I don't know. There would be... classes had usually around 100 people, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And they'd be drawn from all the different places?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it was hard getting over at the local. It was not easy during wartime. We had to stand in line for so many things. There were so many, many obligations that we had to perform.
What was the membership, the total local membership?
18,000.
And this local was just Briggs?
Just Briggs, that's all. Briggs Local 212. And then some of the plants, Werner Highway, would have their plant meetings, you know, separate. So you had people going to department meetings that were called whenever was necessary, not just did it every month. Department meetings, the plant meetings, Werner plant meetings, and they went over to the local. And outer drive meetings over at the local. The local was always behind of activity. But you couldn't pull them out for classes and then whenever we had any kind of walkout or strike, we had mass meetings, you know, to explain. And we had to get out, grind out a lot of information in the voice, in the form of bulletins. Bulletins are going to those plants all the time from that local. I think that's one of the things that made it such a cohesive local.
Now, you know, our teams, as if the education committee must have been particularly radical or class conscious, because at one point there was an attack on the education committee. Were other members of the education committee involved in the SWP or any other political group?
No. Only me.
Did this ever become a problem? Was this, did people know that you were involved?
Yes, everybody in the leadership knew.
And was this
even when they voted me out? No. Not as much as the children. But, you know, I had to earn the respect of these people. No, that wasn't a problem. If the 212 that had factions of CPers like Ford Local and Chrysler and Dodge, some of the others, it would have been a problem. But Emil Mazur came out of the Proletarian Party and he was then in the SP, you know. And these guys were loyal to him and all of his ideas, but it was a personal loyalty. There was no party membership.
Oh, I see. There would have been a difference, for instance, around the no strike tag issue, which the CP supported.
Right.
And you never did end up in any conflict over the no strike. What happened when they finally put the referendum on the UAW on the no-strike pledge?
Well, there was no difference of opinion on the no-strike pledge and the 212 leadership. Except, let me think. No, I don't think even the opposition in 212 was against there. I think they were against the no-strike pledge. That was, at election time there, it was a cutthroat thing. They would charge you with breaking your grandmother if they thought they could get elected. It's just a rough and tumble place with these Italians and Hungarians who fought their way through many battles physically, you know, and
I told you. How did you respond to that, to the rough, abrasive convention?
The women, they didn't get involved too much in the political activities around the local election time. I would say vote the green slate, and they vote the green slate. And they did the bidding and went home. They never got involved too much in the department.
Now, was there an SWP faction in the plant itself?
No, Ernie Mazur, yes, but it was very small. Ernie Mazur wanted to get in the local after I was in. He couldn't get in because of his name. The company wasn't going to let him in, so he got in a Huck Manufacturing Company, and 212 was an amalgamated local that had a couple of other little manufacturing plants in local 212. And he became the chairman, eventually, of the Huck Manufacturing Unit, which brought him over on the general council, you know, general council meetings. What did they call that, general council? I think so. Every local has a different name, but I think that was the general council. And then we had, let's see, one Polish fellow, Glinski. I don't know, maybe we had 3 or 4 or 5.
And would you meet regularly?
We met primarily down at the headquarters of the SWP. And we were all, Ernie and I were always available. They could stop at our house. My house, oh, my house was a meeting place, of course. Whenever anybody wanted to get together on questions of coordinating the activities of Bud Local and Briggs. At my house, this apartment, this rough place that I had, was right near both factories. And so this is where they came. Sure, that's where they came. We had many meetings over there.
So at the same time, you were very involved in the SWP.
Yes, I was. And even in the plant, I was selling the militant.
Oh.
And Ernie and I were the national leaders of the number of militants sold at that time.
And there were no problems, for instance, with the security people over that sort of thing?
Oh, they didn't like it, but I was in a union. It was too strong and gave me protection. That's why we could do it openly, why I could do it and Mary could do it.
You weren't charged with trying to sabotage the war effort or anything like that?
Well, no, they didn't open up on me, but they, oh, God, they wanted to get rid of me so badly, naturally. And I think that's one of the reasons why their foreman gave me such a tough time, but I was able to outwit them because I knew how to talk to women. I think that's why they detested me so much, is because they got me in the department, they couldn't move me, and I was the one who could relate to the women instead of their playboy, little curly-haired Fraser foreman and this other son of a gun that antagonized me. It was a curtain club trick between those two.
Mm-hmm.
The other foreman, I can just see his face. He kind of kept out of it because we had the professionals and those two foremen. And the general foreman was the departments were very quiet too.
You know what
we had a general foreman, assistant general foreman, and a second assistant general foreman. And the third time I was fired, I was clocked when I left my department and went to the restroom. I clocked on the way back, and they told me that I had a pail on me, and they, you know, I always saw the guy.
Now how did that? Oh, let me ask.
They didn't know what to do.
In terms of the SWP. Were there other kinds of things that you were doing within the SWP, or was most of the SWP work devoted to everyone's work within the union? And were you also working on other sorts of things?
And we were working on other sorts of things. There was the Cutter case. We had a committee on the veteran who had, what was his case now? I don't know. It became cause celebre nationally. And, of course, we were very active in the No Strike Pledge against that caucus in the international. And I maintained my contact with Flint, going up there and, you know, within the international. And Sal and I both did. Well, I don't know.
Most of it was directed towards that.
Yeah. And we were running campaigns for president and vice president, and I ran for the United States Senate.
Well, that was after the war, though, wasn't it?
I think
it was 48.
I haven't written down. SWP candidate doesn't have a date on it. It says Flint, August 21.
What was the politics of this education committee? Why did there seem to be such an attack against them?
Well, because they were anti-war, for one thing, you know, and we were supposed to be all patriots at that time. And this is the one thing that the White Caucus, the White Slate Caucus, always, you know, pointed out. They were red-blooded patriots. And because We were all real class conscious people.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't politically conscious. I can't say that, but to a degree they were. But they were class conscious, and they were anti-boss, you know.
And even during the height of the war, their anti-war position was clear?
Yes. Oh, yes. Of course. Of course it was. Emil Mazie, their darling man, you know, on Okinawa, don't you know how he organized the troops in the army to bring us back home? That became a national issue.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Sure, they had a dossier on him that wouldn't quit. He was drafted under protest, issued statements, did not believe in the war, and so on and so forth, the killing and the murder, and he spoke to the local many, many times, and he spoke on the international that way. And, of course, he wasn't the lovely darling that he was in the international at that time either. And then I think they had begun to disband the troops in Europe, and they had them stationed down the soldiers stationed on Okinawa, and he started a big, huge movement, bringing the troops back home, and he organized these soldiers. And that's the last thing in the world that the army wanted, you know. So that his position in there was a very good one. And these people all admired and respected him. He had the ability to speak. Emil is very much like his brother. The Mazies were all this way. They couldn't train anybody else. They had to be, you know. But they developed a loyalty because of their very daring bravado and their they're saying what other people would have liked to have said. And then when they organized this flying squadron with this man at the head of it, believe me, they broke heads, you know. That was the education they had to do during that time, and they were getting through with him. The flying squadron in Local 212. And as the International very often said, they said they're dead end kids, nobody can control them.
It's not that the politics was such in the group, but it was really lofty to someone who had that.
Yes, and a deep, deep class consciousness. Mm-hmm. It would be sort of like the wobbly business, mm-hmm. you know, where they'd go out and fight for mm-hmm. their what they believed in, but you couldn't say that they were politically mm-hmm. oriented. Many of the old mm-hmm. wobblies were just class conscious.
Because the FWP was the only really major group that had an anti-war position, really. You know, that was sort of a controversial and unpopular position to maintain.
Right, it was. The old socialists, quote, you know, would say they were anti-war, but in this case, you know, it was one of those things again where we were out there like a sore thumb being attacked constantly by the CP.
Did the women ever indicate what their feelings were about
this? Yes, the McKinnon were all patriots. And many of the professionals that came in, we had a small group of them, they masked their desire for more money under patriotism, too, you know. They were coming in fancy, leaving their pet teaching profession only because they were patriotic. And yet we knew also the determinants of the money. I think that those that came in out of patriotic duty thought they were helping their husbands. After we had talks in the department over and over again, you know, lunch hours and other times, came to the realization that their problems were aggravated by their husbands had been called over to war, and for what, you know, and I always pointed that out. What did we get at the end of the war, too, except a more hostile Germany and the Bicycle and so on. And we had these little educational meetings practically every day in there. And I think that as they went out of there also, they had a very strong feeling and desire that there would be no more wars, you know, and then the nature, class nature of war. They were changed women, and I think that probably just looking at this microcosm is the thing that gave me such vast disappointment following that trend afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine any of those women. I imagine that the ones that I contacted many years later had gone into other jobs, wherever they could be, lesser jobs, or some of them even got into factories again. And those women were really, they were what women could have been all over the nation, you know, if they had been given the information and the reasoning behind the events that were happening all around them, which they didn't understand. They only had their priests and the newspapers and the radio giving them the, you know, their ideologies previously, and they were changed women by the time that war ended and they went out of that department. And many of them got a measure of that in that local, many of the women, but not a majority mm-hmm. in the other departments, not Rosie the Riveter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, that gave me an idea of what could be done with women, you know? If we only have the opportunity and the means at our disposal. That's why I think the work that you're doing is so important.
Are you going to carry on and get through the third firing?
I would like to think a little bit more about that third firing. I can, you know, it's become kind of a general
yeah.
if you're not
using
it.
You have these notes that you started keeping in May, a week by week. There's 2 weeks.
Do I have those in these papers?
Yeah, you must, because I took them all and you lost them once.
Did you bring them back? I'll
yes.
find them then. All right.
So should we hold?
I think so.
Hold off on them?
Yeah.